You're listening to Conversations That Matter with your host, Terry Conrad.
Welcome to Conversations That Matter. I'm Terry Conrad, and we are having conversations for hearty minds, hungry minds, and hearty discussions. That's what we're doing. And I have a very special guest with me today. I want to introduce all my people to Daniel Monroe. And the way that I know Daniel Monroe is that we just went through a three-month intensive life coaching mastermind workshop with the ever-popular Jacob Sokol from Sensify. And actually, Daniel is coming to us from Auckland, if you can believe it or not, aren't you?
That's right. Yeah, way down the bottom of the world.
The bottom, and there is why. That's why we're having him on the program. Frankly, it's for no other reason, just to listen to him talk because he's got the great accent.
Right. I've heard we sound kind of slow, like there's something a little bit mentally wrong, but if you can accept me for that, then I'll accept you for yours as well.
Oh, that's sweet of you. Thanks so much. Welcome, and thank you for joining me in this. Just so you know, our Conversations That Matter are really directed towards the real estate vertical primarily, but all of my real estate people are also people first. And as you know, we've talked about this many times, I'm trying to infuse sort of the life coaching aspect into the business coaching as well, because we're all people first. We all struggle with a lot of the same issues. And you can't be successful unless you're happy in your life first. So that's why you and I know each other. And I'm so thrilled to know you. And just for our audience sake, I'll let you know that Daniel has done extremely well in his career as a life coach. How long have you been doing it full time, Daniel? Not long.
Yeah, I went March this year, 2014. I went full time. I've completely lost track. It feels like a billion years ago, but what is that? I don't do math. 6-7 months being full-time. I did about 12 months or so part-time before that.
Right. So, and here's where you can so relate to my audience, because you are the hardworking entrepreneur who's been launching a new business, but you've just knocked it out of the park, particularly on the heels of our workshop. You've taken, you know, how many full-time clients are you working with now?
I think I'm up to about 8. I'm aiming to get to maybe 10 before it's too much for my brain to handle, you know, and before I can, you know, I want to make sure that everybody gets that personal attention. So, yeah, I'm up to about 8 now, and I feel like I've finally just crossed that bridge into understanding how you book yourself solid, you know, understanding how you create too much work for yourself rather than not enough.
Okay.
That was a long process getting to that point.
No kidding. And I definitely want to go down there some more. Let's dig into that in a moment. But first, let's give people an idea of who you are, why I think you're so fabulous. I mean, we've had a couple of conversations and you gave me a little bit of your history. And I would love for you to share sort of where you came from when, like, primarily your work history, where you used to work in a prison. Can you share that story with everybody?
Sure. Well, technically, I wasn't working in the prison that often. I was working with people once they got out of prison. I was a probation officer to start off with. I think you guys would probably call it a parole officer over there.
Right.
I worked mainly with guys on parole, so they had served a large majority of their sentence in prison, and they came out and I worked with them. And I specialized in working with kind of the higher-end offenders, so life parolees, you know, murderers, and sex offenders, and, you know, the kind of the tricky people.
The fun, happy people.
Yeah. What was really interesting in working with them is the skills that I learned. It's kind of the effect that those exercises and tools have on somebody who's not a murderer and not a gang member and actually wants help. It explodes with people like that, because it's designed to try and shift people who absolutely do not want to be moved.
You know? Yeah.
So I found that experience really good. And what it also taught me about humans is that I'd say maybe 3% of the people I worked with I'd actually put in the evil category, like psychology's not up to fixing them yet and they need to be kept away from society. But the rest are just, they've got goodness in them and they have this dark side, like we all do. We all break certain rules that we know are rules in our head, our own morals. These people are just on the extreme end of the spectrum. So it was just interesting that, you know, people have this idea that offenders are a separate group of people, when actually they're just extreme behavior versions of ourselves. You know, we all have those tendencies. We all have those that darkness, you know. So, that's where I started my work. I moved up through the chain and corrections, and I kind of overshot. I was so hard out trying to learn how to promote myself, and you know, I was taking big pride in being the youngest in the role all the time and being a big shot, that I got further and further away from working directly with offenders and started to get really dissatisfied with the work. I wanted to be one-on-one with people, and I didn't realize that just climbing the ladder in itself wasn't enough of a reward. It's the work itself that was rewarding. You know, chasing the money didn't actually – I got the money, but it didn't give me what I wanted, and I had to learn that the only way you can learn it by getting the money and realizing that it's not doing what it's supposed to do.
Right.
So that's when I started exploring other options, which eventually led me to coaching.
Which you're an absolute natural with. I mean, we've, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be coached by you a couple of times, and it was always very profound. You have amazing skill. And here's where I think the conversation gets really interesting. Help our people understand, like, what is life coaching? It sounds so kind of hairy-fairy, I think, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, help me understand, why do you do what you do? How is it that you're moving the needle forward for people?
Right. Well, there's a great distinction I want to make, because I don't call myself a life coach. I don't know. I don't like the term. It's too vague or something. It's kind of indicates that you think you're an expert in living, yeah, which I don't want to ever call myself, you know?
Yeah.
So I call myself a confidence coach. Now, the reason I focus on confidence is because I see that as kind of the fuel for everything else, you know? You look at people who do exceptionally well in different areas, and by well, I mean they actually enjoy their lives as well. They're not just achieving, but they're happy and calm and peaceful during that achievement.
Which is exactly what I tell my people all the time. I don't care how much money you're making. You're not successful if you're not first happy.
Exactly. You know, there's some people out there. I know a guy who makes tens of millions of dollars. He's one of the richest men in New Zealand. And, you know, I always use him as an example. I hope he never sees this. But, you know, he's like just so typical midlife crisis. You know, he bought the big car and he kind of cheats on his wife and he drinks. And he's just the absolute picture of why success is not just about how much you have. You know, it's not just about how much you won. Because if you didn't enjoy the wins along the way, if you didn't get sort of internal satisfaction out of those wins, you didn't really win.
Right.
And so what I like to work with people on is finding that deep satisfaction, and I think authenticity is the word that's come up for me the most lately. And what I see it as is an alignment between who you are and who you wish you were.
Ooh,
it's bridging that gap. You know, when people can bridge that gap, they wake up feeling successful. You know, there's no, I could have done better at the end of the day, because you did, you know, you did everything you could and you obeyed your own kind of rules, which, you know, most people don't obey their own rules. You know, I should do this, but I did this. You know, I know that's important, but I did this instead. Or that requires courage, and that's what I need to be doing, but instead I did this. And they feel that gap, and that gap's a really unpleasant feeling.
I think Jacob said it's an example for us at one point was that sort of that ladder and how many rungs on the ladder. I can't remember. Do you remember how he described that?
There are two ladders, I think.
I don't know.
And one is like the kind of measurable success, and then the other is kind of how you feel about it.
I think that's like you know, like the gap between where you feel that your highest potential is and where you're actually currently living. That that gap is as much as you can mitigate that gap is how happy you're actually going to be on the scale of success. And I think that actually makes sense to me. Like I can certainly identify periods in my life where I have felt that there is a larger gap, and I am definitely rockier. I'm not solid. So I feel like that's actually a really great analogy.
Yeah, the big mission is understanding that to bridge the gap is hard, and life is constantly throwing temptations that are more easy but are actually making that gap bigger, you know? So being lazy, you know, being kind of cowardly in the way you approach life, which we all do. That's not an insult towards anyone.
Right.
Yeah, it's... it's doing the things that's I heard a great quote, and I can never get it right when I say it, but it's something along the lines of living the hard way gets you the easy life, and living the easy way gets you the hard life. There's something, that wording is almost definitely incorrect, but for me that basically says it all. Is like, if you want to wake up feeling like you're the best you could possibly be, like you're at your top performance and there's nothing more you could ask from yourself, then you have to do the hard things, not just the easy things.
So true. It's so true. I mean, we all feel so much better about ourselves when we've challenged ourselves and we've met the challenge. Or even if we didn't meet the challenge, at least we tried and we can pat ourselves on the back for like a good effort. But it's when you live small and you're not even really making that attempt and you're just sort of living in fear and protecting yourself that you're unsatisfied because there really is nothing to be proud of.
Exactly. You haven't earned it. Whatever it is you've got, you don't feel that you've earned it. And I don't know, there's this kind of quick fix mentality, this illusion that you can get what you want without pain. There's some illusion out there that actually there's a completely pain-free way of attaining that, whatever your dream is.
The magic pill.
Yeah. And if people can just understand, actually, no, there is always going to be pain of some kind. You get to choose what kind of pain it is. That's the great choice you get. You can either take the pain of anxiety and uncertainty and fear, which is the short-term pain,
right,
in order to do what's right. Or you can avoid that pain and get the immediate sensation of relief and comfort, but that comes with a payment, and that payment is the long-term pain of regret and remorse and all that kind of pain that comes from not living the way you want to be living. So there's going to be pain. If you can accept that, you're going to go a lot further. And actually, the short-term pain is so much better. You know, it's this little sharp, like, disgusting, uncomfortable feeling that then gets a nice big long-term reward afterwards.
Right.
When you go to bed at the end of the day and you think, wow, I did all that stuff that I wish I had done. Like, I actually lived up to my own expectations. It's a great feeling, you know?
I love that. So let me give you an example. I got an email from a girl yesterday, a potential customer, who was reaching out and loved what we were doing, you know, was super excited about the messaging and our spirit and clearly, you know, what appears to be my ambition and my passion. And yet she was stuck on... Her habits have been that she throws money every time she needs something, she throws money at. So she's reluctant to buy our program because she felt that she'd just be throwing money at it again. And my response to her was, well, maybe you're not quite ready yet then, you know, like maybe this isn't really what you're looking for, because this isn't a quick fix. I can walk you through it. I can help you. I can set, you know, an action plan in place for you and marketing plan. But ultimately it was always going to be hard work. It's going to hurt a little bit. And the leads are not just going to fall in your lap. How do you handle your clients when people come to you and they're like, I'm so stuck, you know, how do you kind of walk them through that place where they're not quite ready to invest themselves or do the work?
I think one of the best things I can do is actually create that pain for them right there in the moment. I call it creating a crisis. So rather than waiting 5 years to have a big crisis, you can actually bring that moment to the present. And that crisis is simply understanding that the actions you're taking right now are writing your future. So what I like to often do is I'll say something like, if your future self 5 years from now could call you on the phone, what would they tell you to do? You know, it's things like that where they can actually envision their future and extrapolate their current activity to see what the results will be. You know, most people are pretty happy to buy into the concept that if you keep doing what you've always been doing, you'll get what you always get.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, they refuse to acknowledge that that's what they're doing right now.
Yeah.
You know, they refuse to see the future taking place.
But don't you find that most people get so stuck in the forest that they just can't see those trees, right? Like when you explain it like that, it makes perfect sense. It's so simple. Every idiot can understand and grasp that. But when you're in it, when it's your life and it's, you know, the problems are right there and you're so fixated on them, it's so difficult sometimes for some people to really pull back and get that 10,000 foot view. How do you help people with that?
Yeah, well, there's kind of two different aspects to that. So one is the very process of attaching to thoughts. You know, that's what I call fusion. Well, I don't call it that. It's a psychological term. So fusing to a thought makes it bigger than what it is. It turns a thought into reality, when actually a thought is just a thought. It's a temporary wave inside your mind. It often has no connection to real truth. It's just your mind babbling.
Right.
But you can attach to one little bit of that babble and turn it into this massive thing. And so for that particular aspect of it, what I work with my clients is on mindfulness and diffusion. So understanding that one of the ways to let thoughts slide away rather than creating a reality out of them, you know. And there's a lot of kind of philosophies and stuff that people get into right now that actually creates more fusion. Like, I might piss some people off when I say this. Law of attraction is one.
Yes.
So law of attraction is where you like hard out wish for things kind of thing, which is actually the process of fusion.
Right.
So visioning. You're attaching yourself to thoughts.
Right.
And you're creating a reality out of your thoughts. Rather than understanding that a thought is like a mood or a temperature or a physical sensation, it just comes and goes. It has no consistency until you attach to it. So one of the great things that I like to work with is called psychological flexibility. And it's the ability to be as present as possible and as detached as possible from your own thinking. It sounds, on the surface, when I first heard of it, I was like, how can you enjoy life if you're so detached? But it's not detached in coldness. It's not like psychopathically detached. It's detached in the idea where you see a thought for what it really is, which is just a temporary thing. And if you can detach from thoughts, you can actually enjoy what's really happening. This is what mindfulness is about.
Right.
You know? So one of the great, like, as a more practical tip for your audience is whenever you're finding yourself stressed out and anxious and repeating a thought pattern inside your head and getting worked up about it, start finding sensations in the current moment to widen your experience and conscious awareness. So you might, for example, choose 5 things to identify visually and then listen for 3 different sounds and try to find the temperature on your forehead with just sensation of your skin and trying to find the taste in your mouth and trying to find the feeling of air leaving and entering your body while you breathe. This will create a space where the thought won't be the whole vision anymore. Yes. It'll have to make room for all this other stuff that's actually happening right now.
Love that.
And when you do that, suddenly you're like, what was that thought again? Because it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what a real thought is. It comes and goes.
Right.
So in terms of kind of getting, like, especially getting stressed and anxious, that's always heavily related to fusion.
Especially to stuck in real estate. This happens all the time.
Right.
You get very stressed and anxious.
Yeah, so I didn't close that sale. Yeah. I'm useless. You know, I'm never going to be able to close a sale again. Those are just thoughts. They're about as relevant as having the thought, I am an elephant or I can fly. They're as true as those thoughts. And you can have those thoughts. Like right now, I'd ask your viewers or your audience to conjure up thoughts that are completely false. So conjure up the thought, I am a chair. Or conjure up the thought that I can make things levitate. Whatever. You can make this stuff happen in your mind.
Right.
It's just to show you that a thought can be created without even the remotest evidence of truth.
Right.
You know? And so understanding that a thought is just a thought will create a lot more peace in your life. It'll allow you to let a thought just play. So when it goes, I'm useless, you just go, oh, I'm having a thought that I'm useless. And now it's gone.
So I usually refer to that as sort of like you become the observer. So it's not like you're in your
body. That's exactly what it is.
Right? You're not in your body having that thought. You're up here watching yourself have that thought, and you are detached from the emotion of that thought. Very similar.
This is really, it's power of now, Eckhart Tolle sort of stuff. So some people call it the observer. That's what I call it. In ACT therapy, which is what I'm talking about for a lot, most part, they call it the observing self. It's the one constant that's always been there.
Yes.
So your thoughts have always changed, your moods always changed, your physical body's always changed, but some you has always been there. And it's the way they describe it in ACT, which I like, it's the chessboard. The pieces are moving all the time.
Sorry to interrupt. What does ACT stand for again?
It's acceptance and commitment therapy.
Right.
So it's a psychological practice based heavily in mindfulness.
Right.
And psychological flexibility. That's the overall arching kind of thing. It's used to treat chronic pain disorder, schizophrenia, anxiety, depression. It works on just about everything, but it all depends on the practitioner and how good they are with it, you know. But it's the idea that most of the pain we create for ourselves is the way we react to pain, not the pain itself. So the pain of a bad thought.
Whoa. Back up. Pain doesn't exist. It's just how I react to pain.
pain does exist, but we extrapolate and we magnify it beyond reason.
Why do we do that?
So because of this process of thinking, because we are a type of animal that thinks with language, this is a natural byproduct of that. So if you take being another kind of mammal, say a lion or a dog, they don't think with language. They don't have the words and imagery going in their minds like we do. They just have emotions and reactions. You know, so it's very simplistic for them.
Right.
They're constantly mindful. They don't have the ability to worry about the past, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, not quite. They sort of do have some skills, and certain animals will have different levels of skill. I'm going off track, but the point is, us humans, we think in language. So if we can think in language, then we're going to have the whole range of language from negative to positive.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that will always be there. And understanding that none of it's really truth. It's just the noise of our mind talking.
Right.
It's the, you know, synapses firing, and they create in our conscious awareness words and images. And if we attach to that, that's when we turn it into something bigger. So let's say you've got, let's say depression is a great one.
Mm-hmm.
So depression can either be I'm depressed, where you've attached to it and turned it into your identity and your truth and your reality. Or it can be an accurate view of it, like I'm feeling a constriction in my chest and I'm having a negative thought pattern that keeps coming up. So rather than calling it depression and giving it this big power over you, you just see it for what it actually is, some thoughts and a feeling, a sensation. It takes the power out of it, the impact out of it.
It's absolutely revolutionary. I mean, it's funny though, but you know what this is like, Daniel. I mean, I'm sure there's been times, dark times in your life, you're like, oh my God, I'm so stuck. I can't get out of this, you know? And it's like, you even know better. Like intellectually, you even know I could do better. I can just look at this as just a thought, but oh my God, I want to slip my wrist slowly. So how do you, like when you're stuck in that pattern, that bad pattern, and I think that's what it is. It's just a, you know, it's almost like the bad habit where you're indulging these thoughts over and over and over again. And you just sort of go down that rabbit hole. Like how do you pull yourself out of that?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And the first part is a lot of it. So the first part is actually going, well, what's reality right now? So rather than going, this thought is my reality, finding some sensations, finding taste and smell and touch and, you know, audio and visual, and then making a bigger picture. So you can see that little painful thought you're having is just part of an overall picture rather than the entire picture.
Right.
So zooming out, I think of it as zooming out. You're not trying to fight it. You're not trying to distract yourself. You're just incorporating everything else that's happening and creating a realistic picture. It's only fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not fear to yourself if you're attaching to a thought, because it's like attaching to a sound and saying all there is that sound. That doesn't make any sense, right? Because you know there's more than that. But people aren't as fear when they come to their thoughts. They'll attach to those and give them a greater sense than anything else.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, people are crazy.
Yeah.
We're all crazy.
We're crazy.
With regards to getting stuck in the rabbit hole, as you put it, which I think is absolutely fantastic, the best way I like to deal with it is to observe the pattern that's taking place and try to initiate a pattern break. Mm. So usually, like, this is what I learned from working with offenders, you know, they're coming full circle now. Mm-hmm. This is really it.
We did this on purpose now.
Yeah. This is just totally planned. So working with offenders, we used to do these exercises called offense cycles. And it comes from the understanding that when somebody commits an offense, when they commit a crime, it's not an impulsive thing, ever. Like, there's a big belief in society that crimes are like impulsive, crazy acts.
Yes.
But they never are. There's always a big story that builds up to a crime. Sometimes that story can take place in a couple of hours. So it seems impulsive. But it's actually a conditioned pattern that the person has built up over time in reaction to stimuli of some kind. So a common pattern, let's say for drink driving, might be it starts with the guy going to work on a Friday morning driving his car, despite the fact he knows that there'll be after work drinks.
Right.
So the story started in the morning. And in fact, the story started when he began working at a place that had after work drinks and didn't plan around that.
Right.
You know. Then there'll be more in the pattern as the day goes on. You know, he's having a good time with his workmates. They're joking about how good it will be to, you know, knock off early and have a few brews. And so this pattern's developing. And at any point, he can choose to exit this pattern.
Right.
But if he doesn't, he's going to end up drink driving.
Right.
You know? And it's a very simple one. But these same patterns apply to all the most serious crimes, you know, murder, aggravated robbery, drug dealing. There's a pattern here.
So they, in your opinion, most people recognize or maybe don't recognize, but they are making those decisions and taking those steps towards that outcome.
Well, this is where it's really difficult, is that they're often doing it subconsciously. Right. They're doing it in it's an automatically conditioned pattern that they've developed over time. So at one point it was conscious, but understanding that you're in a pattern can actually be the first catalyst to self-awareness, where you can see the pattern taking place.
Right.
So there's some steps in the pattern that people can start to look for. So what you can do is, after you've had a bad episode doing that thing that you wish you didn't do, mm-hmm. like beating yourself up over not closing a sale or getting anxiety about trying to start something, whatever it is, this thing that you keep doing, this kind of pattern, it's to put it down on paper and actually draw the pattern backwards. So you got to the point where I'm beating myself up for not selling the sale. What happened before that? And what happened before that? And what happened before that? And you just start working backwards until you find the kind of starting point.
Love it.
You know, and there's always a starting point that seems to have no connection often, you know. So maybe, like I said, the first guy, the drink driving guy, driving to work doesn't seem to have any connection to getting drunk at the end of the day and driving.
Right.
But that's actually where the pattern starts. So if he didn't drive to work in the morning, he stops that pattern.
Right.
He has to get a taxi home. His partner picks him up, workmates drop him off, whatever.
Right.
So actually that's where he could interrupt the pattern from the first bit.
Right.
Now there's going to be other key points in your pattern where you can interrupt and move away. You can escape the pattern.
Right.
So let's say, for example, that one of your audience kind of, they go through this pattern, they go to real estate, but they go to an open home that they're hosting. They talk it through with clients and customers, and they try to close, and then they don't. At the end of the day, they go home, they have a few wines, and they get really depressed, and they start beating themselves up. And then the next day, they call in sick,
right?
And then they miss out on more sales or whatever. So this is a kind of pattern that maybe somebody gets. I'm totally making this up.
I love this too, because most of us don't call in sick because we're working from home. So
right, okay.
but I love that. We would call
something
it
else.
Sick. We would just,
yeah,
we
you
would
give just up it. On the yeah. something or whatever.
Totally.
But you'll see there's key points. Now, the first one is the early warning signs. Okay, so straight away, if you look at your pattern, you'll see warning signs that you're building up to that big nasty thing that you don't want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the early warning sign might be like getting yourself down about the fact that you're not going to close before you've even got to work.
So we call those, you know, limiting beliefs.
Right. So you might be starting a conscious thought pattern where it's like, oh, nobody's going to want it, I'm so useless. You might start reminiscing over all the other times you didn't close, that kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So this is where your pattern starts. You're already starting to sabotage your results. So at that point in time, you can exit the pattern. You could choose to engage in some activity that removes from those thoughts, like the mindfulness. You might, every time those thoughts come in, you choose to do a bit of mindful meditation, find other sensory things,
become
and let those
observer.
Thoughts yeah. become the observer, let the thoughts slide away,
yeah.
or just accept the thoughts as just being thoughts.
Right.
Go, oh. One of my favorite things is I get people to write out the story of everything they hate about themselves.
Ooh.
And then they turn the page over and they write, aha, I know this story. It's the I hate myself story or the I'm not good enough story.
Yes.
And they can read over it every day and really buy into it and then turn the page over and just go, oh, yeah, it's that story again. You know,
yeah.
It's not reality. It's just the story that's always playing in the background. So you could do something like that, or maybe it's something more simplistic. Like you can try all these different methods. Maybe you go for a run.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you write down the last 10 closes that you had to remind yourself of how good you are at it. You choose to exit the pattern.
And I find like in real estate particularly, like in any other area of life, it's, you know, it's sort of that wave pattern or the pendulum or whatever you want to call it. It's like, you know,
yeah.
we're swinging one way, things are great, and then it swings back and things are not great. And for whatever reason, when things are not great or going exactly as you planned, suddenly you're beating yourself up. You're, you know, you're just, you're a loser. You can't do anything right. No, la, 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 right? But then mm-hmm. when it all goes well, you're like, wow, I'm a rock star, you know? Like, And it's this like crazy manic existence.
Yeah. So that is another topic on its own. And I kind of, I really think we should switch to that, because I think this is also going to allow people to see some strategies to exit their pattern.
Awesome.
Okay. So one of the main things that causes that feast and famine roller coaster ride,
yes,
is actually attaching your happiness to outcomes.
Right.
So depending on your results is how good you feel about yourself.
Yes, absolutely. We are in a an outcome society. We are looking for good results.
So when you sit down and think about it, how much of your results are actually under your control?
A lot.
Think of all the variables involved. So let's say your result is selling a house or not selling a house.
Right.
Can you control the other person buying that house?
No. All that I can control is how well I present it, understanding and managing emotions, making sure that I'm drafting contracts that are fair and reasonable and serve everybody. There's all those different things that I can control, but ultimately someone has to make that decision.
Yeah. Ultimately, the sale is out of your hands,
right,
because it requires somebody other than you.
Yes.
So everything that you just described has one thing in common. They're your actions that you take.
Right.
So the people are attaching their confidence and their happiness to something that is out of their control. No matter how good you are at your job, the result is out of your control.
Right.
Always.
Right.
So what I really encourage people to do is actually to start measuring themselves consciously and quite objectively on their actions rather than their results.
Love it.
Because that's the only thing you can control. So it's the only outcome you actually have any real influence over.
Right.
Now, ultimately, some people go, well, if I do my job well, I'll get results. Yeah, that's the case.
Yeah.
But doing your job well is the only bit you can actually control. The results. You could be doing everything perfectly and nobody wants to live there, you know? That's out of your control. So when you think about it, how much sense does it make to attach how you feel about yourself to something you have absolutely no control over? You know, how's that going to lead to ongoing confidence and happiness?
I love that. And this is, and so we've come full circle too, to, you know, where you focus, which is that confidence piece. And you do work primarily with men, don't you, in Auckland there?
Not exactly. I do have a subset of work that's primarily with men and social confidence and things like that. But yeah, I do work with the full range as well.
Oh, the full range.
Man, woman,
that's hysterical.
Dogs,
nice. Everything. I think my cat might need some help, but
yeah, cats often do.
No, so I was just, because I know that you'd launched sort of that bro. What did you call
bro-jo.
It? Brojo. Why don't you share a little bit about what you're doing with that program?
Cool. So the Brojo is we call it essential life skills for men. It's the answer to what's missing for men in modern society. It's it came about from my own kind of journey. Now, we talked about my work history a little bit and what led to coaching, but what really led me to coaching was what was happening behind the scenes, which was my own journey with self-confidence.
Right.
So the first 25 years of my life, I didn't know this, but I lacked it severely, self-confidence. And I was what I call a nice guy, capital N, capital G. Now, a nice guy, a lot of people they really get their hackles up when I say being a nice guy is a bad thing. But I really want to define what a nice guy is. Now, for a first part, a nice guy is manipulative. His entire actions are based on making people like him.
Right.
That's his whole purpose in life is to be liked by as many people as strongly as possible. Nothing keeps a nice guy awake more than being disliked.
Right.
Right. So, as you know, everybody has hugely different tastes. So to try and be liked by everyone would be impossible if you were being authentic.
Right.
You're just by being alive, you would piss somebody off, you know, if you're being authentic.
Yeah.
So the only way you can be liked by everyone, and nice guys often are, is to be completely fake. It's to be a different person for everybody that you interact with.
Right.
It's to show, mostly it's to hide things about you that would upset the other person. And I was one of those, and I didn't realize it. It wasn't a conscious decision I made. I've since traced it back to childhood and figured out my own lifelong pattern that led me to be this way. But I'm not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many guys who are like this. And what I found was lacking for men, which women in general, these are all general kind of comments, but women in general have a surplus of, is support. Mm-hmm. So what men often lack growing up is masculine role modeling and teaching as what it means to be a man.
Agreed, absolutely, right? Yes.
Especially in a world sort of like hardcore feminism,
yeah,
where men got the misinterpretation that women want us to be more like them, which is just so not the case. But we kind of interpret it that way. Like, everybody has this. This isn't just male specific. But you have this thing growing up where you're told, like, all the fairy tales and all the movies and your parents and teachers tell you to just be yourself.
Yes.
But nobody tells you what that actually means. They just say, just be yourself. And then you start being yourself because you're a child and you start acting out and you get told off for it.
Right.
So you get punished for being yourself. So you get really confused as to what it means to be yourself, because being yourself seems to upset a lot of people. And so you start developing this kind of murky fake version, you know, like, okay, so being myself means I show this part, but not this part.
Right.
And it means that I pretend to be there and I hide this. And you kind of develop this persona. Or in the case of people like myself, you develop about 1,000 different personas,
right,
that suit different people.
Guilty.
And
done
essentially,
it.
Yeah, oh, so many people have. Mm-hmm. So that was my journey. And what I found, the main reason it took me 25 years to figure out that not only that I was doing that, but that it wasn't working for me and it wasn't bringing me happiness. It wasn't really keeping anybody very happy. Nobody was winning from me being like this.
Right.
Was that nobody pointed it out. There's nobody there to say, you know, have you actually thought about what you're doing and how that affects people and how that affects you and, you know, why you're staying awake every night trying to figure out why things aren't working for you? Have you ever stopped to think that that's maybe your behavior that's causing it? Nobody said that stuff to me. And if they had, I would have listened, because I was all ears for a solution.
Yeah.
You know, like, the whole time growing up, I'm like, something's wrong about the way I'm living and I can't figure out what it is. So essentially, Brojo grew up out of the idea that I wasn't the only one. There are a lot of men in this situation. Now, women, and again, this is really generalistic, but women are sort of raised to be quite comfortable with communicating face to face with other women, mm-hmm, sharing emotions, sharing,
yeah,
negativity.
Yeah, going,
you know,
deep.
Talking about the problems.
Yeah, totally. Where,
yeah,
guys are like patting each other on the back, talking about work, surface.
Harden up.
Yep.
Concrete, you know.
Be a man.
Yep. Exactly, all this kind of stuff, which really steers them away from true masculinity and confidence. So the idea is that actually if we share, that we'll become feminine.
Yes.
You, yeah, know, that's the kind of big fear, is that we'll become women and it'll be like this promise keepers type, yeah, stuff where we just sit around crying
and hugging
and complaining
each other.
That,
yeah.
Yeah. My father never patted me on the back. It'll be like that.
Yeah.
What Brojo is like, it's more understanding that men, again, in general, prefer this kind of linear, logical series of events approach. Whereas if you put a man in a group of women talking about their issues, he won't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
It'll be this foreign language for him. You know, women do this great thing where they talk at the same time with each other, and the guys are sitting there baffled. He can't hear either of them. Whereas he doesn't understand that there's a subcommunication happening where women talk on this kind of different level that guys often can't reach. So what guys need is other guys to say, this is, you're at level 3 and this is level 7 and this is how you get to level 4 and level 5. You know, that kind of approach to solving issues and sharing.
Right.
You know? So they don't need to sit around hugging and crying like they think that it's going to be.
They just need IKEA instructions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they need somebody to just go, dude, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You know? Challenging. They like to be challenged. Guys love to be challenged. As long as they sort of respect the person challenging them,
yeah,
and it's a safe place and that,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Absolutely.
So I kind of figured I'd need that. And then once I put it together and the other guys started showing up, I realized there was a big hunger for it. You know, that these guys, I base it off, and there's these kind of articles I read about tribes in Central and South Africa.
Right.
These kind of untouched tribes that have basically stayed away from civilization, and they, despite how distant they are from each other and having no contact with each other, they often have really similar traditional rituals for guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of those is that about the age of puberty, the guy gets kind of stolen away from his mother. You know, it's this kind of ceremonial cutting of the umbilical cord, right, kind of thing, the apron strings. He gets taken away for anything from days to months to years
on a quest with
adult men to learn what it means to be a man. Right. One will teach him how to hunt. One will teach him how to fight. One will teach him how to be the chief. One will teach him how to woo a woman or whatever. You know, he gets taught what it means to be a man by the tribe standards. And in modern society, that is missing.
Right.
You know, absolutely, guys do not have that. They just, we're mostly a generation of men raised by women. You know, we get told what it means to be a man by women, yep, you know, and I'm not saying women are wrong, but they kind of are.
So, well, now hold on.
Yeah, just to rile some people. But understanding, you know, when I say man, I think what I really mean is masculinity. There are women who can be masculine. There are men who can be feminine. What I'm talking about is not so much male as gender, right, but male as masculinity. So understanding if you're a masculine person, you're a different person to a feminine person.
Absolutely.
It's a difference in the way you act and think.
I'm raising two boys. I have two sons, 26 and 19, you know, radically different men. And they have had a lot of their raising is by, you know, me. Sorry, boys, that's just the way it is. And, you know, and I have often thought that they've needed more strong male role models. And when I say strong male role models, I mean men who really are, I think, introspective, know themselves, are comfortable in their own skin. You know, and by the way, I'm asking a lot of these men role models because their own mom is struggling with those same issues. But, you know, like getting that man who can teach them how to be a man and do it in a way that they can feel good about themselves and be themselves. Because, you know, my oldest for sure got in a lot of trouble, but I do think that this is a big, and again, this is a conversation that matters on a larger scale because we're operating as a, you know, the world's getting smaller and smaller. You know, I think that the violence is probably, you know, a direct offset of the lacking of direction and knowing what it means to be a strong man without having to beat your chest and shoot everything in sight. I do think, you know, I haven't got answers obviously, but I do think you're onto something really important. Where do you see this going?
It comes down to my overall mission, which is to create more confidence in the world. This is all this is about. And I think, you know, I'm trying to think, how does this relate to real estate? And there is something it relates to. And
this is sales. We're all
But sales and chasing your dream, it relates heavily to that. Now, right, what a lot of guys do, or I should say what a lot of masculine people do or want to be masculine people do, is they misunderstand that women will test them. And the test is not asking them to change. It's actually a test to see if they'll maintain.
Okay.
And guys don't get this. And so what a guy will do is he'll adjust because he thinks he's being asked to change and he thinks that's what the woman wants. But what the woman wants is to see that he won't. So that he'll show that strength and that ability to protect and be, you know, be a leader, be a man.
Absolutely.
And one of the things you'll see is, like, we were talking about it last night at the Brojo. A guy will sacrifice his purpose and his passion because he thinks that, well, you know, that's what his partner wants, wow, that he wants, you know, she wants more time and commitment from him, that kind of stuff. He misinterprets that as like giving up on his dreams in order to spend more time with her. And what she really wants is more quality time. Yes. It doesn't have to be more time in quantity. It can be that half an hour you spend a day where he's totally dedicated to her. But during that time, she wants to see that he's chasing his dreams and he won't sacrifice those for her. That's part of the package he comes as, you know, that kind of stuff.
I think that is true. I think, you know, I'll speak for all of women. I certainly do look to my men for strength. There is no question about it. And I don't know if that's, you know, societal, the way we've been raised, what our different roles have typically been over the years. I was a stay-at-home mom for many years, so I played, you know, mommy and wifey and all those things. And I know that I struggle with, you know, how much of my dream and career can I pursue and still be fulfilling that wife role and mother role to my children. You know, it's difficult to kind of find your balance and to know how much can I serve my and love myself and do the things that I need to do for me while still being that important person in your family or your partner or, you know, whoever's life. And I think women struggle with this too, honestly. It's like, you know, how do I, if I'm being too strong and I'm pushing too hard in my career, do you still see me as feminine? You know, am I still a soft place to land at the end of your day? So there is, I think there is both sides. It's a very interesting conversation, honestly.
It's I don't have the answers. I just have questions that were put to me at some stage that changed things for me. And one of the big things was understanding that sacrificing what I want is actually less attractive. You know, I, like a woman would rather hear me say, you know what, I can't date you if you're not going to let me do this, rather than, okay, I'll stop doing that.
Absolutely. You know? Drop down respect. Drop down. I might not love it, but I'm certainly going to respect you more for knowing what you stand for and what you want. Like, there is no question that to me that says strength.
It applies to things like sales as well, you know. So if you're willing to give discounts and be bartered down, it reduces the quality of what you're selling.
Amen. Go on that riff, because that is exactly right. What my people struggle with this so much, particularly newer agents when they're starting out, because we feel like we're sort of the imposter syndrome. We haven't got the experience behind us. We're not really sure what we're doing. We're fumbling. We know this is a huge investment for you. So we feel like we need to bring it all to the front. And so we do posture a little bit, and then that feels inauthentic. And so then everything's off. So then you feel like you have to discount. And it's just like brutal cycle that we all go through when we first start, unless you happen to be blessed and land on a great team starting out the door. But so many of us don't. So how can we enter into a situation like that feeling more confident?
This is one of those things where I understand that there's a process that I've learned that changed my whole life, and that is that the action comes before the feeling, not afterwards. And this changed everything. So same with planning. Action comes before the planning, not afterwards. And so a lot of people wait to feel right before they do what they need to do.
Right.
It's the other way around. You do what's right and it will make you feel good.
Yes.
So let's say, you want to feel good about not budging on the price of something,
right,
you know, of holding strong to what it's valuable. You don't wait to feel confident before you hold strong. You hold strong and that will create confidence. It goes in reverse, which means you have to experience fear.
Yes.
It means you have to choose to experience fear and discomfort and understand that you're not alone, that all the people out there that you admire who are doing the great things, they've all been through that and most likely are still going through it.
Right.
You know, one of the biggest things about being an entrepreneur or being somebody who's trying to make it themselves, like any sort of commission-based job, that kind of thing, is you get this, you know, devastating loneliness. You know, you just think it's just me and I'm doing it all wrong and everybody else has it sorted and I'm terrible. And
complete, you know, isolation. Kind of,
yeah. You're like, I'm out of my depth. Why did I bother? Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Okay? Everybody has a story. And just understanding that everybody has a story can be a huge relief.
Huge liberation.
Oh, sweet. So that's how it actually goes for everyone. Okay, I can accept that.
Yes.
And just understanding, like, one of the things, one of the best things I ever did for my coaching was double my prices. Well, at a certain level, I just saw, like, a random Facebook post from some coach saying, double your prices. And I was like,
All right.
Why not? Because whatever I'm doing is not really working for me right now. And so I was like, well, I can't get any worse, so I'm just going to try it.
And there is sort of that perceived value. Like when you discount and discount and discount, it's like, well, you mustn't be worth very much, honestly.
Right. So one of the best things to understand is people do not make decisions logically. As much as we'd like to believe we do, we use logic to rationalize emotional decisions. The logic comes second. The decision comes first. And before the decision comes an emotional reaction. So if you're so confident in the value of your house that you're not willing to move on the price, they will feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And they will think this house must be worth it. As soon as you can budge, then for a start, they don't trust you.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're like, wow, they were willing to rip me off because they don't actually need to charge that much. They were willing to charge me more than the house is worth. So they obviously don't respect me. And they obviously can't be trusted. And if they can move this much, they can probably move a lot more and so on, so on.
Right.
Like this thought pattern kind of goes through. I mean, I'm not going to tell people how to do real estate.
There is a lot there that we can definitely, we'll have another conversation another day around the art of negotiation and where to come in and position and all those sorts of things. But in terms of just having the confidence when you're entering into the negotiation, like I think you were down a path that was really good.
So I think the main thing, that really sticks with me is this kind of, all the work that I do is around valued living. It's living by your core values. It's living by the rules that you think exist rather than breaking those rules all the time. And one thing is, you know, is understanding, being willing to lose a client because they're not seeing the value that you see, you know? So it's kind of like they're not worthy of buying the house if they don't think it's worth what you think it's worth.
Well, and in our world, it's so like the client is not, like we get paid when there's a close in North mm-hmm. America. Okay. So, and I'm not exactly sure what it's like in New Zealand, but in North America, we get paid when the deal closes, we get that piece. And that's been negotiated up front before we've taken the listing or if we're working with the buyer, same difference. But yeah, so, and sometimes in the middle of a deal, they'll try to talk you down because something went sideways. They had to cut their price more than they thought they would have to. There's a million different discussions around that. But the point is the good agents that know when that's reasonable and know when that's flat out completely unreasonable and they stick mm-hmm. to it. So I completely agree with you. It is a confidence issue and it does come from experience and going through the motions and knowing, you know, who your core, what your core values are, what you stand for, the type of client that you really want to work with and being attracting those clients just by virtue of how you carry yourself, how you represent yourself in the world.
Yeah. I think what I'm really talking about here is a philosophy of abundance. And one of the questions that might have been raised by what I said before is, you know, you take the action, then you feel confident. Mm-hmm. Is, well, how do you take the action if you're not feeling confident?
Right.
You know, like how does that work?
Good question.
Well, first is understanding that you don't need to feel anything to take an action. Feeling doesn't dictate how you behave. You choose to behave a certain way. You can, for example, I work with a lot of people with social anxiety and I get them to approach strangers to overcome it. They don't feel confident approaching those strangers.
Yeah.
Usually they're bricking it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But they can still walk and talk.
Yes.
So the action can still be taken. They don't need to feel good to take the action.
Right.
It's a myth that that's required. The other thing is understanding, like, how do you get yourself into the mindset of somebody who is confident before you take action?
Love it.
You know, it's not exactly faking it, but it's kind of just having a self-awareness. How would I behave if I was confident?
What would I
do differently? So I used to have this mantra that used to keep me going, which was, what would a confident person do?
Ooh.
So it was whenever I was unsure.
Mine is, what would Beyonce do? What would my inner Beyonce do? she's fierce. She'll take it. Yeah.
I love that. So mine used to be, what would a confident person do? Another one, like, you know, if you're in real estate, what would I do if I had 10 people waiting to buy this house?
Mm.
You know? What would I do if I had 100 houses about to close?
Right. There's no scarcity in the way. We're not fearful of losing any money or losing any clients. Mm. We're going to be completely abundant and it's all going to work out in the end. So therefore, how is that going to affect how I handle this situation?
And it comes from understanding you have to believe that it's abundance that sells, not scarcity.
Right.
So a lot of people will think, well, I don't have 100 houses to close, you know, and I don't have 10 people waiting. I've got no one waiting. Nobody wants to buy this mm-hmm. piece of crap. And, you know, I should just sell it to whoever I can get my hands on.
Right.
But that desperation will drive that one buyer away.
Yeah.
That's what people don't see, the link. That neediness drives people away. And they know that when people try to sell to them, but they can't reverse it.
And in this noisy world, I mean, let's just pull it back. We've been talking for a while now, but I would love to go quickly into, you know, in this very noisy world, salesy, salesy, salesy. I mean, you've done a great job of building your own business and generating your own sales and your own clients. So we know that you understand this concept. How would you advise, just as a final last tip before we go into our legacy question, but how would you advise an agent to approach that, like, just carry on where you were, kind of. You know what I mean? So, like really, like, how should a client or an agent approach when they're starting out? They have no business. They are scared. Frankly, they are fearful. There is a mindset of scarcity. I have nothing happening. I have no business coming. I don't know where it's coming. How do they get past that to a place of, you know, creating a business?
Great question. There's what a lot of people do when they're starting out is they feel that they have no experience and no results yet.
Right.
You know, they go, there's nothing to base any confidence on. There's no evidence.
Bingo.
When that happens, look to other areas in your life where you've succeeded, because there are others. The fact that you're alive today means that you did something well. You at least finished your breakfast, you know. You at least like managed to survive this long in spite of all the perils out there in the world. So go back and find other things that you succeeded in doing. A really common one, for example, is learning how to drive a car. You know, when you first get into a vehicle, it's terrifying, mm-hmm. right? Especially, I think you guys call it a stick shift over there.
Yep.
A lot of people don't know what those are anymore because they're just being phased out. But, you know, that's it's like trying to drive a spaceship, right? You've got all this stuff going on, and it's kind of like a bit of a dance with the perfect muscle movement of your feet and the clutch, and let alone steering and other people and the fact that you're in something that kills people regularly. And, you know, it's this terrifying experience. 10 years later, you're texting and eating and driving, and you don't even pay attention.
Right.
Now, a lot of people are okay to learn how to drive in spite of that fear because they see so much evidence that other people have done it.
Right.
You know, you look around, everyone's driving, so therefore I must be able to learn how to do it.
Right.
But they don't look for that in other areas of life where it's not so obvious, like starting your own business. You don't see hundreds and thousands of entrepreneurs. You don't see everyone being an entrepreneur successfully and assume that, well, it must happen for me as well.
Right.
But so in order to create that experience, you need to kind of do a transference type thing. So rather than going, okay, I haven't sold any houses yet, go, what else have I managed to influence people to do? Or what else did I do that I thought was really difficult and it took me a long time to learn and now I'm good at it?
Right.
You know, what was the underlying concept? So rather than like, okay, well, I drove my car on a Wednesday and a Saturday every day, you know, every week for a year, and I got my learner license or whatever you guys call it over there. Yeah. Rather than doing that, go, well, I put a lot of hours in. I got mentoring. I kept doing it even when I felt scared of doing it. I trusted that I'd eventually learn it. These are the underlying concepts that you can now apply to this new thing that you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know you can learn how to drive a car. You know that you finished your degree at university, or you know that you dated someone long enough for them to become your partner. You know that you played in a sport. There's something you've done in your life successfully. Absolutely. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you can get through that process, you can get through any other. It's the same thing. It's learning a new skill until you're good at it. It's one of those things. Some people are natural at things. They learn them quicker. Other people apply a bit of learning technique to learn something quicker, or they get a bit of luck.
Yes.
But in the end, anyone can do anything if they go at it long enough.
Yes.
You know?
Maybe not the best.
And if you enjoy
it. No, basketball star or anything like that. That's probably not my immediate future, but I can shoot a hoop.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You could get to the point where you play in some sort of, local game or whatever.
Sure.
And do it to a point where you're still better than 95% of people out there because they've never done it, you know? And it's the same with real estate. You might not end up being, Richard Kiyosaki or whatever his name is.
Robert Kiyosaki, yes.
Yeah, right, Robert.
Poor dad, awesome rich dad. Rich dad, poor dad.
Yeah. You might not end up being him, but you could still be the person who makes six figures a year.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? You could still be the person who has a great lifestyle.
That's a completely reasonable goal that most can achieve if they apply the right principles and be prepared to do the work, frankly. Like, the problem is, I think, with real estate is we attract a lot of people who have a misconception about what the business is going to be. And I think they think it's going to be turnkey and they're going to walk in and everything's just going to start magically happening for them. And they just show up and sell houses. And of course, they learn pretty quickly that that is not the case, that it's like anything else. It's a lot of hard work and they need to invest in themselves and in their business. But once they grasp that concept and they're ready to show up and do the hard work, then there are many, many successful agents, many.
Yeah. And just like when you're learning how to drive a car, there are the times that you stalled, there are a couple of little fender benders that you had, there are times that you, you didn't take the corner properly, or the times where you just couldn't get up and do it and you had to wait till the next day, whatever. If you can assume that whatever it is you're learning is just like that, it'll be the same process, and you're willing to go through that, then you'll be fine. It'll just be a matter of time and effort. That's all it is.
Why do people need coaching? Like, why can't we just do this stuff on our own?
One thing I'd say is that nobody needs it to survive, but how quickly you want to make progress and how how many mistakes you want to make before you get it right will be quite often determined by coaching. That's so that's, which is why I invest in coaching.
Me
because
too.
I wanted, yeah, I wanted my business to get off the ground quickly rather than take 10 years of misery.
Absolutely.
Now I could have done it all by myself by trying every possible idea as to how to make it work, gotten into heaps and heaps of debt and done it that way. And that's an option for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an option for anyone. And I never, whenever I'm talking to someone who's considering whether or not to enroll with me for coaching,
yeah,
I almost always say, you don't need this.
Yes.
You don't need, you can live without this. This is not food. This is not medical care.
Not air.
This is not, you know,
yeah,
this is not the fire service. This is, you know, you can do without this.
Yes.
But how well you do is whether or not you invest in it.
Yeah.
So if you want to take, you know, like I took about 5 years of personal work on my own social confidence and my self-confidence before I started getting support.
Wow.
The next 6 months, I made more progress than I had in the 5 years before it.
That's crazy.
That's why you invest in coaching.
Yeah.
You know, it's because you have someone there who can just allows you to troubleshoot and move forward so much more quickly. And I think I heard a quote that's really the best way to put it is, people want coaching because we all desire someone who will make us do what we need to do.
Right.
And that's the way I see it. Yeah. And frankly, coaching isn't even about accountability. It's about learning how to be accountable to yourself.
Absolutely.
So creating this thing where it's not like you want to do it because the coach wants you to do it, but you want to do it because you know it's the right thing to do,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Well, and plus, you've probably gotten into the position of, you know, setting some actual concrete goals that may have been very loose before you worked with your coach. They kind of probably were, you kind of knew what you wanted to do, but you certainly didn't have deadlines. You certainly didn't have the structure, and they might have happened eventually, but it wasn't like, okay, by next week at noon, this is done.
I think there's a great, I'm a big fan of Eben Pagan. You know, he's a serial entrepreneur. He's worth following. The guy's the guru of all gurus. And it's funny because very few people that I speak to know of him, but he's probably one of the most successful guys on the planet in any kind of area you want to look at, health, well-being, business, money. He kills it in everything.
Really?
And yeah, he's just such an awesome dude. And one of the things he talks about in business is usually the most successful approach is counterintuitive.
Mm.
So whatever you think should work doesn't. It's the opposite that works.
Why is that?
It's because we're kind of educated as we grow up by people who are just following patterns rather than doing what works. You know, we don't have time to get into what I think of the school system and stuff like that.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, let's just say it's yeah, the evidence is there to show that it's really guiding us away from what works rather than towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was doing for those first 4 or 5 years of conscious self-development, not really making much progress,
mm-hmm,
but just chipping away at it like a hard worker every day trying the stuff, was I was trying stuff that didn't work and not realizing it. So I was trying stuff that I just like being nice, you know, a nice guy where you try and please everyone.
Yes.
Often trying to win, like to actually be loved or whatever it is you're,
yeah,
trying to achieve, they just try to be more nice rather than realizing that being nice is the wrong way to go. And even understanding that it's not the behavior, it's the motive behind the behavior that's creating the dissatisfaction. So it's fine to help someone, but to help someone because you want them to like you, that's where it gets toxic.
Yes.
But to help someone where you don't care what they react, that's different. And it's the same with business and coaching. Is the coach might be able to go, hey, that's not how it's done,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
and suddenly just wake you up to the idea or just make you see it.
Yeah.
You go, okay, so you've tried that for 6 months. What are your results? And you just stop and go, oh, damn, there are none. Maybe that doesn't work. I did that with, I was trying Google AdWords for coaching.
Yes.
Now, Google AdWords, perfectly reasonable tool to advertise for certain things. For people to sign up to intensive coaching, they're not going to click on an ad and sign up to intensive coaching,
no,
but they will click on the ad.
Yeah.
They might not sign up, but they'll click on the ad. So you get these statistics telling you that all these people are clicking and that they're just, you know, absolutely excited about the wording and the perfect little diction that you've got in your ad there, and they're clicking away and costing you a lot of money.
Yeah.
I spent 6 months and about $6,000 getting those statistics up and up and up. And then my coach at the time, Phil Drolet, He said, "So how many people have you got from that?" And my world shattered. Oh. I was like, "None. Oh my God, none." All the statistics are meaningless. There's nobody who's actually enrolled to coaching. Everybody that enrolled to coaching had been people I had approached and spoken to and invited to a session.
Yeah.
That's what actually worked.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh my God, I spent $6,000 in 6 months before I realized that, and I just needed one person to question me."
Yeah.
Because I was looking at the wrong thing and I didn't know it, you know?
Yeah. Completely agree. I do think that that is invaluable, as that sort of that team partner person you can bounce ideas off of and have it sort of reflected back to you what you're even doing. Because sometimes you just can't see it.
Here's the other thing about coaching is you're not investing in the coach, you're investing in yourself. So if you can't do that, how do you expect to build the courage to build your own business or to become really successful or to take the risks you need to take in order to be the best if you can't even like give yourself a bit of faith, right? So if someone's thinking about enrolling with you for support with real estate, mm-hmm. yeah, they can do it themselves, but if they don't even have the courage to invest in themselves by working with you, how are they going to have the courage to do it all by themselves? That's even scarier.
I think it's so many people just starting out in this business, though. They just don't, you know, they just honestly don't know where to point their nose. And I feel for them. Like, it is a challenge. And it is for so many entrepreneurs in any industry, really. It's just, you know, I think that, you know, you have this idea of how much, you don't want to put out too much money because you're worried about what's going to come in. Like, there is, again, that scarcity mindset, I think, which is a big one to get over. We could talk about this all day long. You are so insightful. You have so much knowledge and wisdom. I'm really, really grateful that you decided to join me for this conversation. And I think we touched on some big stuff, frankly. Some pretty big stuff.
Yeah, I find, I don't know, ever since I started coaching, I just can't have a normal conversation anymore. It always has to get all epic and philosophical. But it's fun.
I'm down for the epic and philosophical. That's super cool.
Yeah, you are.
I want to know, here's something I ask all of my guests. I'm very, sure. This is why we're doing conversations that matter. It's like, you know, life matters. What we're here going around once, as far as I can tell. And what I want to know, and from all of my guests, I invite particular people for particular reasons. And usually I have like a very strong affinity. I love your mind. I love the way you work. I love your values, you know, those sorts of things. I wanted to ask, what is it, you know, you're at the end of your life, you're looking back, how does Daniel want to reflect on what his life meant? What is the legacy that you want to leave?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's kind of what drives me forward. And it's what I said before. I've developed the belief, or the theory, you might say, that the secret to happiness is not pursuing happiness, it's actually pursuing self-confidence. And I want to teach people that not what it means for them and how to live, but the process to develop self-confidence. I want to have an impact where basically the legacy I leave behind is that people are upgraded in confidence.
Ooh, I love that.
One of the things, you know, it really started with offenders. What I saw as the most common cause of criminal activity was self-confidence issues.
Wow.
100%. You know, often it looks like it's alcohol and drug issues, but alcohol and drugs came from self-confidence issues. So I saw there was only a few offenders who I considered to be genuinely confident people, and they were the psychopaths. And these are the ones that I'm like, watch out. Yeah. You know, they love themselves. They have no self-confidence issues, but they also really enjoy hurting people. So that's a different kettle of fish. But 98% of the people I worked with, and that figure is probably pretty accurate, they were trying to fill a hole in themselves through their activities. You know, they were lashing out based on feelings of self-loathing and low self-worth.
Mm.
And what I've realized in my short time on this planet is you can learn self-worth. You can learn confidence. It's a way of taking responsibility for your actions in your own mind and engaging in activities that increase your self-confidence. That's all it is. Anybody can do it, just like anybody can learn how to drive a car or, you know, communicate or whatever.
Right.
There's very few people, I think, who have the actual mental limitations that would stop them building self-confidence. I mean, like, I know this guy, and he's in Idaho, I think. He's got Down syndrome, and he runs a restaurant.
Wow.
You know what I mean? I know plenty of people with high IQs who wouldn't know how to run a restaurant.
That's, yeah, me being one.
Yeah. Sean Stevenson, he's a great example of somebody who hasn't let physical disability get in the way. It just shows that, like, unless, I think, out of all the people I've worked with, unless there's significant brain damage, So the person's been, you know, significantly violently abused, or, you know, drinks methylated spirits or something like that. As long as your brain is relatively functional, you can learn self-worth, because I think the theory I'm eventually getting to is that you're born with it.
Mm.
And it's all it is rediscovering it.
Ooh, and we chip away at that, don't we? And then it's like you have to like come full circle and go back and find it and build yourself back up again.
I heard a quote that I think defines it, and you'll have to excuse my French here. So the quote is that we're all diamonds covered in horse shit, covered in nail polish.
That's awesome.
And that's from the book Supercoach by Michael Neal, I think his name is.
I love it.
And the way I understand that is, you know, we started off fine, and then everybody else piled their crap on top of us. Yes. Their fears, their misconceptions about the way the world works, their attempts to control us and all that kind of stuff. That's where all the crap got piled on. And then we tried to make that crap look good.
Right.
We're like, well, that's who we are now, so we'll try and make it look good. When actually we started off spot on. That authenticity that I always talk about, that complete vulnerability. One of the things I like to say is that being completely vulnerable makes you invincible. There's nothing that can be used against you once it's all out in the open. It's like Eminem at the end of 8 Mile. You know, he does his big rap and then the guy's got nothing left to say.
Yeah.
So authenticity is this kind of courageous vulnerability. It's the bit where you go, whatever I am, I'm just going to let that come out and I'm going to accept however that affects the world, you know, rather than trying to moderate whatever it is.
Wow. Yeah, that's so epic. And I think we need to ruminate on that for a while and just really think about, you know, who even am I at the core? I mean, I bet there's so many layers of stuff that we've kind of all even forgotten a little bit who we even actually are. Like that stuff that we need to peel back the layers and get really raw.
Yeah. One of the questions I set out to answer is, what is the how in just be yourself? How do you actually do it? Because it's such a vague question and it's such an impossible question to answer. And the closest I've come so far, and this is a work in progress, is you simply don't try to be anything else. So the word try there, the effort you put into like trying to keep other people happy or trying to impress someone or trying to be cool or trying to be interesting, you take away all that effort and you just see what actually comes out. You know, what comes out when you take the filters off? What comes out when you stop moderating yourself? And at first it's a nightmare, I'll promise you that, because it's going to be this, you're waking this dormant beast in you that's got a lot of things it wanted to say over the years and finally gets to speak. But that kind of starts to play itself out, and what you'll find is just this relief in not having to try.
Yeah.
And just being spontaneous and mindful and just whatever comes into your head comes out, whatever action you want to take, you take. You're not trying to achieve anything, you're just being, you know? And it's this kind of just letting you happen. It's just like you just observe it. You just watch it.
I love that. I think that's
the closest I can come so far.
That's going to be the theme of our conversation that matters, is like the learning to just be, which is, I think, beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I think we're going to wrap it there, Daniel. I am so grateful that you joined me for this conversation. It's so powerful. I do these as a passion project for myself because, frankly, I just love having them. But they're so good, and I'm super grateful. If someone wanted to get in touch with you, what is the best way? I know you have that inspirational, what is your
lifestyle.
Website? That inspirationallifestyle.com is the website. How else can they reach out to you if they want to connect?
I like connecting with people one-to-one. So they can just email me. It's just dan@theinspirationallifestyle.com. Nice big word for an email there.
Perfect.
Or just look me up online or whatever. You know, I don't have any filters in between contacting me. You can phone me or Skype me, whatever it is. I'm happy to talk to anyone.
And you can give me those details, and I'll make sure to include those in our post. So that's awesome. Thanks so much.
All right.
I really appreciate it. You are a rock star coach. You really are. Thanks.
Awesome. I love talking to you.